service.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
This episode contains content that may be disturbing to some listeners. Please check the show notes for more information.
Badlands is a production of Double Elvis.
Way out in California, a happy bride and day. We're planning for the Christmas, not very far away. They had a little daughter, a sweet and goodly child. All the folks up you hurl a merry and Parker smile.
The stories about David Lynch are, actually, they're quite normal. Almost bizarrely normal. Especially for a dude who's made some of the most psychologically haunting films and television shows of all time. But the stories that inspired some of David Lynch's work, those are insane. Like the 1908 crime that was the basis for his revolutionary television show, Twin Peaks. That crime involved a brutal murder of a girl in a small town. A seemingly idyllic town that, beneath its surface, was full of prostitution, orgies, deceit, and corruption. And it was all fueled by a political machine so powerful it could cover up not one, but multiple murders. The story of Hazel Drew inspired David Lynch to make great television. Unlike that clip I played for you at the top of the show, that wasn't great television. That was a fair use sample from the Library of Congress of Alan Pope performing Murder of Marion Parker in 1938. I played you that clip because I can't afford the rights to Steve Barron's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And why would I play you that specific slice of radioactive reptile cheese? Could I afford it? Because that was the number one movie in America on April 8th, 1990. And that was the day that Twin Peaks made its television debut. A show about an unsolvable murder inspired by an actual murder that was intended to remain a secret. On this episode, a dead girl, prostitution, political conspiracies, unsolvable mysteries, and the secret origin of David Lynch's Twin Peaks. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Badlands, Season 9, Hollywoodland. Lawrence Gruber woke up to the summer sun in his face and a cloud of flies buzzing around his head. The rest of his friends were still asleep. Weekends, every summer, they came out to this spot, Teal's Pond, a mile from Troy, New York. And they drank and they fished and they shot the shit. Being a teenage boy in 1908, it wasn't all that different from what it is now. Lawrence tossed the blankets aside and took a piss behind a tree. He wandered back to the campsite and assessed their supplies. Nothing for lunch. Someone was going to have to go back into town. His friends were snoring, and Lawrence figured it might as well be him. He got dressed and he set off on the long walk along the edge of Teal's Pond. As he walked, he saw something floating in the marsh, a dark lump he couldn't make out with the sun glaring from behind it. He thought of the antics with his friends the night before, how one of them had torn off his shirt and whipped it into the pond in a drunken frenzy. That was probably it, just a shirt. Lawrence put it out of his head and made his way into town. Later, as he was walking back, the sun beat down from directly overhead. The object in the pond, the thing he thought was a shirt, had floated into the shallows, closer to the path he was on. He could see it clearly from where he stood. It looked bigger than just a shirt now. He got closer to the shoreline, and then his eyes went wide. He screamed out loud for his friends to come quickly. There was a dead body in Teal's Pond. The other boys came running, but they pulled up to a stop next to Lawrence when they saw the body. Face down, arms outstretched as if reaching for them. Blonde hair floating on the surface around the head like the tentacles of a jellyfish. Black, crescent-shaped combs studded with rhinestones tangled in the strands. The slow lap of the tide made it look like the body was breathing. Lawrence asked the question they were all thinking. Should we haul it in? None of them wanted to be the one to do it. So one of the boys ran off through the marsh to find an adult. He came back with a local farmer, who had seen something floating in the pond the night before, but, just like Lawrence at first, figured it was nothing. On their way back to the body, they saw something else in the reeds. A black straw hat with three ostrich plumes and two black kidskin gloves pinned to its brim. The farmer fished the hat out of the water. The milliner's mark, a sort of signature by the hat maker, was torn out, but there was a hat pin there, a four-leaf clover with the letter H. The farmer and the boys waded into the pond and dragged the body to the shore. It was tough work. The body was weighed down by the girl's elaborate dress soaked with pond water. They stopped to catch their breath before flipping her over. A few of the boys went into town to fetch the authorities. They told everyone they saw along the way. By the time they got back with the town doctor, a crowd was hovering around the pond like the black flies that had hovered around Lawrence when he was asleep. They all wanted to see who exactly this dead girl was. Carefully, the doctor rolled the body over. Her skin was black and wrinkled. Her eyes and tongue bulged out from her face. And below her chin, a length of pink ribbon was looped tightly around her neck. Her body was so bloated from days in the water that the ribbon was embedded into the girl's flesh. The doctor carefully cut the ribbon free, knowing it didn't make any difference. It felt like the kindest thing he could do. A boy watched from the crowd. He knew who she was. Knew it even before they flipped the body over. He talked with a girl wearing the very same dress about a stone's throw from this very spot just 5 days earlier. But the boy clammed up. The boy wasn't saying shit about that now. The body was taken to the nearest funeral home. A team of doctors worked diligently to determine the girl's identity and the cause of her death. And none of them recognized her by sight alone. But that could have been due to the state of her body. She was in her early 20s, blonde, medium build. Her eyes were clouded over, but they'd been blue. The fancy dress and hat meant she had money to spend. She wore no wedding ring. Beyond that, the only clues were the H on the hat pin and the initials H-I-D scratched into the back of a brooch. Her lungs were full of air, thus the reason why her body was bobbing on the surface of the pond. And there was no water in her stomach, and that ruled out drowning. There was a blood clot on her brain from a blow to the back of her head with a blunt object, a rock or a club. It hadn't been hard enough to fracture her skull, but the doctors said it would have been enough to kill her instantly. Then, there were the bulging eyes and the tongue, and that pink ribbon around her neck. The doctors argued in the cramped basement of the funeral parlor. Some thought she'd been strangled. Others weren't so sure. Each doctor shouted over the other, until finally one voice silenced them all. It was a blow to the head that killed her, same as it was with Billy May. Billy May. That name had been on all their minds, but none of them wanted to speak it. 3 years earlier, Billy May Brown had washed up dead in another lake a few towns over. She'd gone out rowing with her boyfriend, She planned to tell him she was pregnant, and when she did, he beat her to death with a tennis racket, then capsized their boat and swam to shore. Billy May's murder was still fresh in people's minds, which meant people were going to ask, was this new dead girl pregnant? Was Billy May's story playing out all over again? The doctors didn't check to see if this girl was with child. If they did, they never said. There was no evidence in the police reports of a pregnancy or of a sexual assault. The determination that the girl had died of foul play meant that the DA's office was going to get involved. The district attorney himself looked like he'd step right out of a Western. Tall, dark, and handsome. A rare Irish Catholic in New York's mostly Protestant Republican Party, the DA was known for his toughness on crime as well as his party loyalty. He put out notices in the local papers about the girl's body. 2 days later, no one had come forward. So the funeral director prepared to bury her in a pauper's grave. Then the doorbell of the funeral home rang. The funeral director opened it. A man stood in the doorway. The man spoke in a shaky voice. He'd heard about the body found in Teal's Pond in that fancy dress with the black straw hat and ostrich plumes. Based on the description, it sounded like someone he knew. His daughter, Hazel Irene Drew. The funeral director thought of the hat pin with the letter H, and then the brooch with the initials H-I-D carved into the metal of the backing. H-I-D, Hazel Irene Drew. Angelo Badalamenti sat at an old Fender Rhodes piano. David Lynch sat next to him. A cassette recorder sat quietly on top of the keyboard. It was 1988, and Lynch was assembling the project that would become television's Twin Peaks. It was a huge risk for the director. The arthouse auteur behind such underground classics as Blue Velvet and Eraserhead. This was long before The Sopranos and long before what's called prestige television. Back then, talent like David Lynch did not work in television. Television was considered by some to be trash, but David Lynch was a visionary, and he was currently trying to envision television as art. His starting point was a story his co-creator Mark Frost had told him about. Local history from the town in upstate New York where Frost grew up. It happened 80 years earlier. A beautiful blonde girl was found murdered, floating in a pond in the woods. Lynch was using that story as inspiration as Angelo Badalamenti worked on an evocative composition by his side. "Okay, David," Angelo said. "What do you see now?" David Lynch closed his eyes. He was there, in the woods, in the dark. A soft wind blew through the pines. On the keyboard, Angelo slowly alternated between an A-flat and C minor. The bass was slow, like the lapping of the pond water against the shore, the breath-like movement of a body floating on the surface. "That's good," David Lynch said. "Now, from behind a tree, there's a very lonely girl." And the music rose. It came out of the dark and drifted to the shore. And then it built to something bright, but sad, a ghost glowing in the dark woods. It was so beautiful, the vision, the music, that it broke David Lynch's heart. Then it all fell back, sinking into the darkness until there was only the low pulse of the waves on the shore. David Lynch jumped up and hugged his composer. "That's it," he said. "That's Twin Peaks." In the spring of 1908, Hazel Drew and a group of her friends went to see a fortune teller. Spiritualism and seances were all the rage, and some of the girls were true believers. But Hazel thought that it was all just bull. "Look at this guy with his chintzy turban and flowing robes, telling each girl a version of the same story." A tall, dark man will come into your life, and a handsome blonde stranger will sweep you off of your feet. The death of a distant, forgotten aunt will bring you sudden riches. But when the fortune teller got to Hazel and started at her palm, his face went pale. He paused for a moment, and then he spoke. "You'll be dead before the end of the year." Hazel Drew, who would be transfigured by David Lynch's imagination 8 decades later into the character of Laura Palmer, first seen wrapped in plastic when Twin Peaks was broadcast into 20 million homes, was a poor country girl whose family lived in the woods near Teal's Pond. She moved out of her family's cabin when she was young and took a job working as a domestic servant in the city of Troy. Troy was a town of metal refineries and textile mills, only a short train ride from the state capital in Albany and a few hours from New York City. In 1908, Troy was one of the richest cities in the U.S. Hazel's first job was in the house of the city's first treasurer, who happened to be a major player in the local Republican Party. He was married with 2 kids. Hazel was only 16 when she began working for him. Hazel continued to work for the treasurer until 10 grand went missing from the city's coffers and he became embroiled in a scandal. They pinned it on his deputy, but he still resigned in disgrace. It was at this time that Hazel resigned her post in his house, and she never gave a reason. Next, she took a job in the home of a coal merchant who happened to be another powerful local Republican. On her first Christmas in the new house, Hazel complained she wasn't feeling well. She decided to go stay at her uncle's cabin in the woods by Teal's Pond. She'd been there for 2 weeks when an envelope full of cash arrived from her coal merchant employer, along with a note saying that she'd been replaced. She came back to Troy and took a job in the home of a third prominent Republican, a professor at the local college who was also the city engineer. He was accused in the press by overstaffing the city's engineering department with incompetent cronies, shocker, pulling ridiculous salaries, but the district attorney never got around to investigating. Hazel Drew left her position there without warning, without reason on the morning of July 6, 1908. That was just days before her body was found. When she left that final house, Hazel packed her suitcase with all of her things and dropped it in a locker at the train station. The next night, a local boy who was in the crowd that gathered around the discovery of Hazel's body, the one who recognized her by the dress alone, ran into Hazel as she walked in the tall grass near Teal's Pond. This was the encounter that he didn't say shit about. He thought her dress was just about the prettiest thing he'd ever seen. He couldn't forget it, though he knew a boy like him never stood a chance with a girl like her. And it was later in the evening when a man who ran the hotel at the edge of town saw a car driving up the hill towards Teal's Pond. He could see a man in the driver's seat and a girl in the passenger seat. But when the same car came back down the hill, this time there was no girl, just the guy behind the wheel. 3 days later, Hazel Drew's body was found floating in Teal's Pond. Think about this for a moment. Here's a dead girl, one who had worked in the homes of not one but 3 major players in the town's local Republican Party. All of them married men, and at least 2 of whom were involved in some sort of scandal. She made $4.50 a week, that's about $150 today, and her employers and friends said she was quiet and demure. She was a churchgoer who had admirers, but she had no boyfriend. Hazel Drew was a good girl. But Hazel was also a girl who wore the finest clothes and took regular train trips to New York City to pick them out. Witnesses had seen her on the train with different men, or meeting different men at the station, or even double dating with friends in one of the touristy lake towns nearby. As the DA and his investigators dug deeper, there seemed to be 2 Hazel Drews, the prim church girl, and then another girl who was living it up way beyond her means. The money was coming from somewhere, and it wasn't from the $4.50 a week she was making over the table. Maybe Hazel had a boyfriend she hadn't told anyone about, one from a rich family. Maybe, like Billy Mae Brown, Hazel had been killed by someone she loved, murdered in a rage. Maybe she'd been romantically involved with one of her married employers. The DA noted that Hazel's sudden illness and weeks of recovery looked an awful lot like a girl trying to get rid of an unwanted pregnancy. What if the envelope of cash that showed up from her boss wasn't severance pay, but the first installment of hush money? Or maybe that envelope came from Ma'am Faye,
the madam of a half dozen row house brothels in Troy's booming red light district. Ma'am's house just happened to be next to the police station. Cops came in regularly to, you know, check on things, but they rarely made an arrest, and they always left happy. Ma'am's house was a few blocks from the home of Hazel's second employer, and right behind the campus where her third employer taught. Ma'am Faye was always looking for new recruits. Girls in that line of work made piles of money quick, but they burned out just as fast. A full-timer in one of Ma'am's houses might have 150 clients in 1 week, but not all the girls were full-time. Some kept their day jobs and turned tricks at night for extra cash. Cash to buy fancy clothes, cash to catch the train to New York for a blowout weekend. But there was another theory, one that connected Hazel's extra income to the woods near where she'd been murdered. Because Hazel Drew wasn't the first pretty young working girl in Troy to go missing.
We'll be right back after this word.
All right, I know my listeners, and I know that some of you are sports fans, and I know that some of you are also fantasy sports fans. So I want to tell you about Prize Picks, the largest independently owned daily fantasy sports platform in North America. They are also the easiest and most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. It's just you against the numbers, okay? You're not teamed up against your cousin Greg or your Aunt Poppy or whatever, 1,000 other players in this whole league. You don't know who half the people are. Instead of battling numerous other players, including pros and sharks, you simply pick more than or less than on 2-6 player stat projections for the week, and you are in. Prize Picks is really simple to play. So this is for you, whether you've got experience with fantasy sports or you just want to dip your toe in and see what all the fuss is about. See what everybody's talking about every weekend. You can make your picks and submit your entries in less than 60 seconds. And they got a lot of different sports, including, of course, football, which is all we're talking about right now in the fall. Now, for me, I can select from receiving yards, rushing yards, passing yards, receiving touchdowns, rushing touchdowns. I'm in the app right now and I'm looking at the upcoming games. I'm going to select Bryce Young, if you can believe it, for less. I guess you can't believe it. For less than 203.5 passing yards. I'm going to select CJ Stroud for less than 244.5 passing yards. And the Swifties' new favorite, Travis Kelce, I'm going to select him for more than 74.5 receiving yards. Major League Baseball playoffs are here as well. I can select from total bases, pitcher strikeouts, hits allowed, overall fantasy score, and much more. I'm going to take right now Vlad Guerrero Jr. for more than 1.5 combined hits, runs, and RBIs. Bryce Harper, also, what a beast. He played like a madman in that first game of that series. Bryce Harper, going to select for more than 1.5 combined. And Trey Turner, I'm going to go more than for Trey Turner as well. You get the idea. This is easy. It's fun. There's not a lot of complications. To make it even easier, Prize Picks now offers Apple Pay for quick deposits into your account. Prize Picks also discounts select player productions up to 25% to provide even more value. So get in the Prize Picks app and check it out. Go to prizepicks.com/badlands and use code badlands for a first deposit match up to $100. That's prizepicks.com/badlands and use code badlands for a first deposit match up to $100. Prizepicks.com, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Minnie Clifford woke up with a start. Deep in the woods, she could hear someone screaming. Her husband kept on snoring next to her. Minnie slipped out of bed and went to the window. A fingernail moon lit the pines. Their little cabin was tucked away in the woods by Sam Lake, a few miles from Teal's Pond. It was quiet. And Minnie told herself that that's the way she liked it. She told herself she didn't miss the noise and bustle of the city. The scream came again. And from where she stood, Minnie couldn't tell if it was a good scream or a bad scream. She knew a thing or two about good screams. Back in her city days, she had been one of Ma'am Faye's girls. Only for a few months, just to scrape some cash together. Ma'am used to tell the girls to put a little life into it. Some nights, the whole house would swell with screams as the girls tried to outdo one another with their performances. But this scream, coming from the woods, didn't sound like that kind of scream. This scream didn't make Minnie nostalgic. It made her think of the men who thought their money bought them the right to rough her up. of the girls who never came back from their last client of the night or didn't show up the next day. When that happened, Minnie told herself that the girl must have left town. She must have taken her money and bought a little cabin off in the woods, someplace quiet. Minnie told herself that, but she never believed it. A chill ran down her back, and she listened a minute longer. Nothing but owls and crickets and frogs on the pond. Minnie climbed back into bed, but it would be a long time before she fell back to sleep. A few miles from the spot where Hazel Drew's body had been found, there was a private resort camp called the Alps. It was owned by two brothers, furniture dealers in Albany, who were big in the state Republican Party and well-connected in Troy. As a rule, what happened at the Alps stayed at the Alps. It was a frequent summer locale for Troy's richest and most politically powerful. So any rumors of the goings-on there got quieted down real fast. In fact, after Minnie Clifford told police about the scream she heard that night in her bedroom, she quickly turned around and denied to the DA that she'd said any such thing. But secrets were tough to keep in Troy. People talked. They talked about wild sex parties at the Alps, local businessmen and politicians, and plenty of available girls. Some of those girls on loan from Mam Fay. Some recruited from the factories. Girls who wouldn't have sex for money, but might be wined and dined into a compromising position. And deep in the woods, at the Alps, there was no one to hear them protest, no one to hear them scream. When conversation turned to the orgies at the Alps, it also turned to another dead girl whose murder had gone unsolved 7 years before. Like Hazel Drew, Mammy Killian was a pretty girl who found her way from the country to the bustle of Troy. She worked in the factories and drew the attention of several men above her station. And like Hazel, Mammy was found dead, floating in the Hudson, a blow to the back of her head, and a ribbon wrapped around her neck so tightly that by the time her water-bloated corpse was found, it was embedded into her flesh. The medical examiner ruled it a suicide, but the press had questions about how a girl managed to kill herself by a blow to the back of her own head and violent strangulation. The medical examiner shrugged it off. The police didn't bother to investigate. A local brewer, who happened to be Troy's former mayor and a former United States senator, anonymously offered a massive reward for information leading to the discovery of Mamie's killer. The brewer ran the Democratic machine in New York, which was just as corrupt as its Republican counterpart. And the information that got dug up in pursuit of his reward money linked Mamie with several major players in the Republican Party. Stories surfaced about rich Troy residents wooing girls with trips to Albany, wine-soaked boondoggles that ended in the state capitol's red light district. There were also reports of factory girls being offered joyrides and automobiles and luxury coaches and then taken out to the Alps. Mammy Killian, they suggested, was an innocent girl caught up in the local Republicans' web of sexual perversion. And when she tried to defend her honor against some unidentified predator, she was killed. Evidence, rumor, and hearsay mounted. The citizens of Troy, riled up by the sensational press, demanded the police investigate further. But the medical examiner's ruling of suicide stood. Witnesses recanted their testimony or outright disappeared. And after a few weeks, the case was closed. And who let the case close? The same lawman who was now letting the Hazel Drew case flounder without a suspect. Maybe the DA didn't want a suspect. Maybe that's why he tried to hush up the witness who saw the car speeding toward Teal's Pond the night of Hazel Drew's murder. He told the press that the driver had been identified, but refused to give them a name. What was the DA covering up? And why did it seem like Hazel Drew, a girl who was either lily white and innocent as her parents and friends claimed, or a girl with a bad reputation as some of the newspapers were starting to hint at? Why did it seem like she was connected to half of Troy's prominent Republicans? Just who left Hazel Drew dead in Teal's Pond? It washed up on the river's edge, near the Blue Pine Lodge, wrapped up in a large sheet of plastic. Pete Martell was the first resident of Twin Peaks to discover it. He was walking by, on his way to go fishing, when he stopped dead in his tracks. He got closer. The plastic was a little opaque, but he soon managed to figure out what was inside. It was a body. A girl's body. Pete called Sheriff Truman, who arrived at the scene with his deputy and the town doctor. They unwrapped the plastic. A body as gray as the Pacific Northwest sky. Lips blue. Skin waterlogged and peppered with sand. They knew immediately who the 17-year-old girl was. Everyone in Twin Peaks knew her. Sheriff Truman, the deputy, the town doctor, Pete Martell, they all just stood there, choking back tears and thinking the same thing. Who killed Laura Palmer? That was a central question of David Lynch's groundbreaking TV show, Twin Peaks, television's first ever auteur-driven series. Twin Peaks combined elements of soap opera, young and dream analysis, slapstick comedy, and horror, wrapped them all around a murder mystery that boiled down to that one question. That question was also the line used by ABC's marketing team to generate buzz for the show, which became an unlikely hit when it debuted in April of 1990. But David Lynch wasn't interested in answering that particular question. He didn't really care so much about solving Laura Palmer's murder as much as he did telling the stories around the murder. To Lynch, it was all about the mystery. Not just of Laura Palmer's fate, but of the entire town of Twin Peaks. The waitresses, the truckers, the bad boys and the good girls. And the federal agents with their insatiable hunger for coffee and pie. The strange woman who kept a log for a pet. And the bizarre man who talked backwards. That's what Twin Peaks was about. The things that couldn't be easily explained. The secrets that people kept. But ABC didn't want a show built on secrets. They wanted the truth, which David Lynch knew always gets in the way of a good story. Hazel Drew had a secret, and she wanted to find out what it was worth. She knew it was worth something to the right people. There were those two brothers, the Albany furniture dealers who owned the resort in the woods known to locals as the Alps. They would have an interest in keeping rumors about wild orgies and missing girls quiet. And there were the Democratic politicians, eager to get dirt on one of Hazel's former employers, all of them prominent political rivals. And then there were the Republicans who might pay to have that same secret hushed up. On the day before she was murdered, Hazel Drew took the train from Troy to Albany, a rat's nest of political corruption. Half an hour later, she turned around and came back. Later that afternoon, a phone rang in a bar in South Troy. The bartender picked up. He was more than a bartender. He was also a low-level operative for the Republicans, kind of guy who might visit several ballot boxes on election day. He nodded as the voice on the other end spoke. He didn't say much. He hung up and called the local livery. Hazel was walking the streets of Troy, feeling sure of herself. No more domestic work in her future. Her things were waiting for her in a locker at the train station. She was getting out. The bartender pulled up alongside her in his rented car. He asked if she wanted to go for a ride. Hazel loved riding in cars. She loved being in motion, on trains, on trolleys, on ferries. And she knew the bartender from the bar and around the neighborhood. Why the hell not, she figured. One last ride through the woods. One last lap around Teal's Pond. The bartender was chatty. He wasn't the kind of man Hazel had to be afraid of. He wasn't powerful like the men who lured girls like her off into the woods and made them disappear. He was a boy from the neighborhood, splurging on a nice ride for a night out. But by the time they got to Teal's Pond, something had changed. Maybe it was the nervous edge. Maybe it was being back here in the woods where she'd grown up. The bartender was headed towards a dive bar frequented by lumberjacks and roughnecks who lived outside of town. Hazel asked if she could be let off here by the pond. The bartender agreed and said he'd pick her up on his way back into town. Hazel drifted along the edge of the bank as the sun began to set. The few carriages that passed by thought they saw not a girl, but her ghost, picking berries and letting her hand trail along the tops of the tall grass. She was saying goodbye to all this. She was ready for her next life. She didn't hear the car as it came back and parked nearby. She didn't hear the sounds of the bartender trudging across the marsh in his nice shoes, coming to carry out the order from Albany to silence Hazel Drew for good. Hazel instead listened to the critics. The owls started to wake as darkness set in. She watched the last sliver of the sun disappear into the trees, right as the club struck the back of her head. When her body was found days later, the DA didn't want it to look like they weren't bothering to investigate. But he'd also gotten word, and it was loud and clear. Don't investigate too deeply, and keep your hands off the bartender. In August 1908, after 1 month, the DA declared the case closed. The murder of Hazel Drew was written off as unsolvable. For the rest of the century, people passing by Teal's Pond at dusk might see the ghost of a girl picking berries, trailing her hand along the tops of the tall grass. Her story was whispered around 100 campfires, and it famously inspired David Lynch's dark vision of a dead girl wrapped in plastic. But before there was the story of Laura Palmer, there was the story of Hazel Drew, a story that ought to be in pictures. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Badlands. Badlands was created by me, Jake Brennan, and produced by Double Elvis. Credits for this episode can be found on the show notes page at badlandspod.com. Subscribe, follow, like, rate, and review the Badlands podcast wherever you get your podcast, because Badlands is available everywhere. If you love this show, tell someone, tell everyone, shout us out on social, spread the word, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Double Elvis.